is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Our guys set that tone with the way we play open gym in the fall, and they understand the standard and what it takes to be successful at Emory. And then also our strength and conditioning staff, they do a really good job with our guys in the preseason.
Jacob Flegel is a men's basketball assistant coach at Emory University. Prior to his hiring at Emory in 2021, Flegel spent 3 seasons on the basketball staff at Juniata College. His final campaign, he was the associate head coach. Flegel went to Juniata after serving on the Carnegie Mellon staff. Prior to his experience at Carnegie Mellon, Flegel was at Waynesburg University, where he was the Yellow Jackets graduate assistant for 2 seasons. While a student athlete at Waynesburg, Flegel started 102 of the 110 games in which he appeared. He became the 33rd player in Waynesburg history to record 1,000 points, finishing with 1,070. Following the 2015 season, he was named to the Capital One Division III Academic All-District team. Hey Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Justin Brantley from Helium Sports and Entertainment Marketing, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. You'll want to have your notebook handy as you listen to this episode with Jacob Flegel, men's basketball assistant coach at Emory University in the state of Georgia. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Hunzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, and we are pleased to be joined by the assistant men's basketball coach at Emory University in Atlanta, Jacob Flegel. Jacob, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Thanks for having me, Mike. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Excited to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all the things that you've been able to do in your career. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about some of your first memories of the game of basketball.
Sure. Yeah, I think my first memory of kind of organized hoops, you know, was in third grade. I went to a basketball camp that was kind of a family back home that was like the basketball family. You know, all their kids played hoops growing up, and they ended up running a camp every year for kids and trying to obviously build the game in a pretty rural small town where hoops wasn't really super popular. It was more of a football type place. And I just remember going to that camp in third grade. I honestly don't even think I wanted to go, if I remember correctly. But I went anyways. My parents put me in the car and took me. And next thing I knew, I couldn't wait to go back the next day and the next day and the next day. And really started to look up to a guy named Drew Schubick, who his mom was the one that ran it. And then his dad was the high school coach at the time. But Drew was phenomenal, went on to play at Sacred Heart University and then overseas in Germany for a while. But I ended up being the water boy on all high school teams and kind of following up through. And, he was kind of that initial guy that really lit the spark for me.
You never got hooked on football?
I didn't. I played flag football up through middle school, and then hoops was always at the forefront. So I just stuck with basketball.
Gotcha. All right. So as you're getting into your high school career and you're getting a little bit older and you're taking the game a little bit more seriously, and obviously we'll talk a little bit about you going on to be a college player as well. What do you remember about what you used to do
to improve your game? Were you playing a lot of pickup? Were you working with a trainer? Were you working out on your own? What was your process for becoming a better player?
Yeah, there, you know, growing up in Jennerstown, Pennsylvania, population of maybe 500-600 people, there wasn't really much basketball being played. It was really me just, you know, at my house, or there's a small playground, just down the road that I walked through, and just kind of me and a ball. And, I think that was good and bad in that, you know, obviously you'd like to be able to play with other guys, play pickup, play 3-on-3, 4-on-4, 5-on-5, whatever the case may be. But I do think there's something special about being able to, have yourself and a ball and a hoop and use your imagination and your creativity. Certainly lets you get up a lot of shots, on your own, and a lot of rebounds with that too. So there wasn't really much pickup to be played. It was more myself. And then, you know, like I mentioned before, I had Drew there to kind of look up to. And, in the summers, as I got older, I'd work out with him a little bit. But honestly, I think one of the biggest things for me developmentally, going up through middle school and high school was the AAU that I played. And my dad actually started an AAU organization, kind of in our area, because if anyone around wanted to play AAU or wanted to get on a travel ball, you had to drive an hour and a half to Pittsburgh. And that's obviously hard to do with a family, you know, two or three times a week to practice and then tournaments on the weekends. So my dad ended up starting a team, which ended up turning into about, I think at its peak when he was running it, he had like 10 different teams and everybody coaching for him. And to my knowledge, he never made a dime off it. He just did it for all the kids in the area that really wanted to get into basketball and really wanted to, you know, to get better and have that opportunity. And through that, a bunch of his players, both boys and girls, ended up playing college basketball because of it. So that was pretty special.
That's pretty cool. Who was the first GM? Was it you or your dad?
If you would have asked me then, it would have been me, but because I was the one picking out the jersey colors and everything. But
all right. Okay, I gotcha. It's funny because now I'm a lot older than you, but back when I played, there was very little. I don't even know if we called it AAU at the time, but I was the GM and I just picked up. I'm like, okay, who are the best kids in the surrounding communities around me? And my dad ended up coaching our team, but I kind of served as the, I think when we started the team, maybe I was, man, I might've been 14 or something, 15. So I was a 14 or 15 year old GM, just calling people up, trying to wheel and deal and get people to play on our team.
Yeah.
Back in the day. That was when there was like in the whole city of Cleveland, Ohio, there was maybe two teams. There was one from like the west side of town that was ours. And then there was another team kind of from the east side of town, and completely different landscape than what it is now. But that's pretty cool that you and your dad were able to put that thing together, and obviously gave you a great opportunity, but also gave some other kids in your area that, as you said, would have had to previously travel and maybe had that be out of reach for them to be able to be able to do that. Is your dad's not still doing that anymore?
He's not, no. He ran it up till COVID, and then insurance costs, and it was harder to find kids to play and coaches, and so it has kind of fallen off since. But he ran it, I mean, probably when I was in seventh grade, we started, and he would have run it for 12-ish years, 10 to 12 years, somewhere in there.
That's cool. What's your dad do for a real living?
He is a production supervisor at Lockheed Martin, actually, in Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
Nice.
So, yeah.
All right. So he's a hoops junkie on the side.
He is. Yeah. He's a high school official now. He has really gotten into that, ever since the AAU organization, kind of took a back seat. He's gotten really into high school officiating the past couple of years.
Good for him, man. Cause we need more people that'll officiate. I would never ever in a million years want to be an official, but I am thankful that there are people out there that want to take the abuse and do what it takes in order to be an official, because that, as you well know, is a thankless job. So kudos to your dad for wanting to do that.
Absolutely. And we live, or my family lives in a pretty rural area, as I mentioned before. So they're traveling half hour, sometimes 45 minutes to games just to officiate. And so it is definitely a thankless job, but appreciate the people that do it.
Absolutely. All right. Tell me about your favorite memory from being a high school basketball player.
Oh, that's a good one. We were fortunate, like I said, basketball wasn't necessarily the main sport around, but there were a lot of good athletes, you know, football players and some baseball players, everything. So we had a really good high school team that was primarily made up of multi-sport athletes. I think I might have been the only, there's probably me and one other guy were the only kind of true just basketball guys. But we were fortunate to win a lot of games. And, the kind of the way it's set up back home is you have your conference championship and your district championship. So you have a chance for 8 total times cutting the nets down. I think of the 8, I think we got to 5 of the 8 during my 4 years. So we were fortunate enough to cut a lot of nets down, and I think I still have those in a box in my parents' house.
Nice.
Somewhere.
There you go.
So I just think those memories with my team and being able to have that success and kind of do it together. So that was great.
When did college basketball get on your radar? Was that something that you thought about from the time that you were a little kid, or was it something that became more of a reality as you were kind of out in the AAU scene and getting exposed to it? Or just when did you decide, or when did you know that you really wanted to play college basketball?
I think I've always really had an affinity for college hoops. I never was super interested in the NBA, to be honest with you. I've only, probably since I graduated college and got into coaching have I really started watching the NBA, but I was always fascinated with college hoops. I really think kind of my freshman year of high school, I didn't play a ton. We had a really good team, didn't play a ton as a freshman. But just that I was going to all the camps, and it's Hoop Group now was the camp at the time and is the camp now, more so than 5-star that has gone by the wayside a little bit, but I started going to camps and really, obviously that AAU opportunity and just playing against really good players. And it, so I think once I got into high school and had, a year or two of playing pretty high level basketball and AAU wise, that's when it really started hitting me that, man, this could be a reality. Like, I think I have the ability to do this, and, that would be pretty cool if so.
How much familiarity did you have with the process of recruiting and choosing a school and the different levels and what was going to be a good fit for you? Or were you kind of going in flying blindly?
Yeah, we were flying blindly. I have an older brother and he played basketball, but it was never as much of a passion for him as it is for me. So he played on the high school team, but he was never trying to play in college or anything. So it was really, it was pretty new to myself and my family. And we had interest at all levels, going through the process. So feeling it out and kind of going through and figuring out where to visit and everything. It was definitely eye opening. I certainly, in hindsight, I don't think I was prepared for it at the time, but you figure it out as you go a little bit. So.
Absolutely. What do you remember in terms of your criteria for what was important to you when you think back to yourself as a 17, 18 year old kid?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, for me, a place that academically was good, I wanted to know that I was going to be able to do everything I want to do post college. And, after those 4 years, cause I knew I wasn't an NBA player, maybe play a year or two after college, which didn't end up panning out, and that's fine. But I never thought that I was going to be a professional basketball player. So I think I was really looking for a place to kind of set me up for those 4 years. Honestly, at the time, I didn't realize that it would be for college coaching, but as it has played out. But and then for me, my faith is important for me. And so having a place where it didn't necessarily have to be a Christian college. Waynesburg is. But just somewhere that I could explore that a little bit, and go a little deeper. And then, lastly was the connection that I felt with the team and the coach, of whatever school was recruiting me. That was pretty much how I based the visits that I took were, those conversations that I had with coaches and, that relationship that we had started to build.
What relation or what things that you went through and your own experiences have helped you as you start thinking about the recruiting process now on the other end of it as a coach, when you're trying to talk with kids and trying to talk with families? What are some things that you learned along the way in your own experience that you think you can now share with the people that you're recruiting or the kids that you're recruiting?
Yeah, I think the sooner that you can identify what are those two or three keys that, that you're looking for, the better, obviously the smoother your process is going to be. That's a question that I ask our recruits now, you know, early and on in the process when I'm talking to them, or, you know, what are the two or three things that you're going to base your decision on? And then, you know, we go about evaluating if that checks the box for us, or, you know, if we have to say no, or if they have to say no, and that's fine. We understand it. And I think the earlier you can have those transparent conversations, the better off you're going to be.
Yeah. When you don't want to waste either side's time, right? It's a matter of, hey, is it a good fit for us as the school on that end of it? And then conversely for the player, when you start looking at a school, you don't want to spend a bunch of time at a place that you're probably not going to end up going for whatever your own reasons may or may not be. You mentioned a second ago that you maybe didn't plan to get into coaching, or that wasn't your thought when you went to school. What did you first think of in terms of a career when you went to school? What were you thinking about besides getting an opportunity maybe to play after you were done? What were you thinking about from an academic standpoint?
Yeah, I went into college thinking I was going to be a high school teacher and maybe coach some high school basketball. And then as I got into the process, like I said, I loved college basketball. And then as I got into the process and, you know, Coach Christner, who I played for at Waynesburg, he and I to this day, he's one of my closest mentors and a really good friend now. He started talking to me about, you know, well, do I have interest in college coaching maybe? And I ended up going to VCU before the summer between my junior and senior year. I ended up going to VCU and working camp with the assistant coach at Waynesburg at the time. And I just, my eyes were opened, and it was one of the coolest experiences ever that I could think of at that time. And, you know, I met a couple other friends who were working their first camp. And to this day, we still all keep in touch and have built pretty good friendships. And so I think kind of just over my 4 years, and then, you know, I came back from that camp saying, okay, well, how do I go about getting into college coaching? And then, you know, ultimately led to a GA position and was fortunate to have my master's paid for and begin my coaching career, and then, you know, kind of move up through the ranks that way.
What was it like for you transitioning from playing to coaching? And you also get to do it at the school where you just got done as a student athlete. So that adds, I don't know, another interesting wrinkle in that, okay, you went from being a player in the program to now suddenly you're on the other side of it. And a lot of guys that you played with are still part of the team. So just obviously you were excited. You knew that was a direction that you felt you wanted to go after having the camp experience, just kind of really starting to have your eyes opened, as you said, to what it would mean to coach in college. But what do you remember about the transition from playing to coaching?
Yeah, I think it was a little bit unique. Like you said, given that I stayed at my alma mater to start coaching. So I had those relationships already. You know, you have to kind of set some different boundaries with those relationships. You know, some of my best friends still on the team, and I just can't hang out with them. I can't go over to their house and hang out anytime I want, or they can't come over on the weekends, you know, whatever the case may be. But you still, obviously, you know, you value those relationships and their importance from a personal standpoint and a coaching and professional standpoint. So you have to set other boundaries. You know, I was a captain for a couple of years at Waynesburg when I was playing. So I think there was a little bit of that feeling of respect that had already been established throughout my playing career that certainly helped as I moved into that coaching role after I graduated. And I also think Coach Christner giving me opportunities to be on the court, kind of teaching and coaching right away and being, you know, in the mix right away and not just, you know, off to the side or charting anything. You know, that was really, really important because guys got to see me in that light and see me in a new role in a coach setting. And I think that helped with that as well.
How long did it take you to go from the player coach relationship to more of a coach to coach colleague relationship with your head coach? Because I know that obviously when you're playing for somebody and they're your head coach, there's one relationship and then it clearly has to change in some way. But I know that as a player and as somebody who has made their life now in coaching, that we always have a ton of respect, right, for the people that coached us. And I'm whatever, 53 years old now, and I still see a high school coach that I had, or I see a college coach, and I still call him coach. It's not like I'm suddenly calling him by their first name just because of the way that relationship was. But obviously for you, that change. So what was the transition like there in terms of your relationship with Coach Christner?
Yeah. I mean, he'll always be coach to me. His number is still in my phone as Coach Christner, and it'll always stay that way. But I think the relationship we had as a player, I was part of his first recruiting class at Waynesburg. And he inherited a program that hadn't won very many games. Before he got there, Waynesburg was a pretty big NAIA power, back, I believe, in the '80s, made it to some Final Fours, had some nice runs, but there was never really, as they transitioned to Division III, there was never really much Division III success to that point. So I think going through that process with him and being part of a group over that 4 years that kind of turned the program around a little bit, those bonds were pretty deep and pretty special. And I think it was a little bit different than some of my classmates who, as they graduate and they move on, I was with Coach every single day and then in the office for 2 more years and my classmates had moved. So I think our relationship changed quicker than a lot of my classmates, which was interesting just talking to them and that dynamic. But I don't think it took very long. He's been a phenomenal mentor to me and has helped me, even as I've moved on from Waynesburg and now he's at Calvin, coaching the women's team at Calvin. He's still, we talk all the time and he's still a big part of my life and my coaching life as well.
What part of coaching in those first 2 years as a GA did you take to right away that you thought, hey, I feel like I have some natural ability in this area, or this feels like something that I can be really good at? And then I'll ask you the second part of the question, what was maybe a little bit harder or something that you maybe weren't as prepared for as you thought? So something that came naturally and then maybe something that you had to work a little bit harder at.
Yeah, I think what came pretty naturally to me was just building relationships in general, because I had so much pride in Waynesburg and I wanted us to be so good. And so as we brought guys to campus and as we started, getting the guys in the gym in October and all that stuff, that was all easy for me to talk about Waynesburg. And it was because it was so fresh, obviously I just graduated. One of the things I did as a GA that I think was invaluable is I just found, I started to really dive into kind of the national scene of Division III basketball. I've always been attracted to Division III. I want to be a Division III head coach someday. But I really wanted to just get to know Division III basketball as much as I could. And so I just found some of the, best programs in the country at that point in time. And, over in the off season, I just emailed some of the coaches, some of the head coaches, assistant coaches. Some got back to me, some didn't. And I was just, can I pick your brain for 10 minutes on the phone? Can I meet you for lunch? I'm going to be out in your neck of the woods recruiting next week, whatever the case may be. And I was just trying to find, what are the common threads? And one of my favorite questions to ask is what makes a good assistant? What are you looking for in a good assistant coach? And the resounding response I got was the ability to recruit. If you can get players, if you can build relationships with guys, it sets everything else up. So I really, I decided I was going to make that my thing. And I wanted to be a really good recruiter. And to do that, I think you need to be able to build relationships. You have to really know the school that you're working at, the academic standards, the fit piece, what you're actually looking for on the basketball program from a basketball standpoint, all those things that go into it. I just decided that was what I was going to try to do. And again, I think it tied into the relational side of things.
All right, let me ask you this about the recruiting side of it, because I think that one of the things that's interesting is obviously at each institution where you coach, there are different parameters, things that you're looking for, whether that's the academics, whether that's the style of play, whether that's the personality of the head coach. So at each of your different stops where you've been, how long did it take you to build a feel for the type of player that was going to have success in that program? So as you're having conversations, obviously, with your head coach, you're looking and coaching the players that are already in the program. How long does it take before you feel like, okay, I got a really solid feel of what types of players and individuals and students we need at this particular school?
Yeah, I don't know that it's necessarily a specific time. I think there's always a baseline level of, you know, athleticism and skill. You know, as now in my eighth year, just finished my eighth year of Division III coaching, I feel like I understand that baseline level of athleticism and skill. But I think the details of what, you know, for example, Juniata College, where I was before I came down to Emory, stylistically, it was a tough kind of blue collar defend, rebound. We're going to run motion offense and make you guard. And so understanding the intricacies of that and the details and kind of the mentality that guys have to have and that specific fit, it probably does take a recruiting class to really feel like you know what's going on. But as, you know, like I said, there's definitely a baseline that you can tell and you can see right away, but to really understand it, and to understand the school, you know, retention is so big right now. Obviously with the transfer portal, it's as easy as it's ever been to transfer. And especially with the state of a lot of small colleges, you know, financially post COVID, retention is huge on everybody's mind. And so, the ability to identify people who are going to be a good fit at your program is so important, for that ability to retain them. Then,
when you think about retention, obviously the first move there is to get the right people in the door so that there's not as much of, they're not looking for the grass being greener on the other side of it. That's a part of it. But what do you guys talk about? Like, what do you and Coach Zimmerman talk about when it comes to making sure that you can retain your guys? When I think about retaining, I think about two scenarios where you have a kid who's A, really excelling early, maybe as a freshman or a sophomore, and that kid's going to potentially get an opportunity to go and maybe play at a higher level. That's one category. And then I guess the other category would be the kid who maybe comes in as a freshman, doesn't play as much as they thought, but you guys feel like, hey, this kid can be a really important part of our program in the years ahead, but maybe that kid's down because they didn't play as much as they anticipated or that much as they thought they should have as a freshman. And then those are other kids that sometimes leave. So what's the conversation like when you start talking about trying to keep your roster together? What do you guys talk about?
Yeah, it, for me, it gets to the complete student athlete experience. You know, what are they, how are they doing socially? You know, what clubs, what other activities on campus are they in? You know, we want our guys to be involved in stuff outside of just basketball. You know, we obviously don't want them to be involved in everything under the sun because at some point you're going to be stretched too thin. But I think that balance is important. Then the academic piece, you know, are you having success academically? You know, are you doing well in your classes? Are you in the major that you want to get into? You know, for example, did you get into the business school after your sophomore year at Emory? That's a big thing for business majors here. And then obviously the basketball side of things as well. And I think the biggest part of that is being truthful and honest with guys and establishing a role. If you can establish a role for a guy and show them what success is going to look like for them, as opposed to, you know, walking in somebody else's shoes, I think that goes a long way. And it helps establish expectations, for the player as well.
Yeah. That truth telling is, I think, critical when you start talking about making sure that guys are on the same page. And not that obviously you can tell guys what they want to hear, or the old saying, you can tell them what they need to hear, which is the truth. And I think that ultimately, even if a player is hearing something that they don't necessarily love what they're hearing, they still appreciate hearing the truth, as opposed to somebody who tries to sugarcoat it and kind of dance around. Well, hey, this is, you know, maybe it'll work and maybe you'll end up being a, you know, instead you just, hey, this is where we see you. This is where it's at. And if you want to change that, here's what you can do in order to be able to do that. And I think players, even though they don't always love to hear that truth, I think ultimately everybody's a lot happier in the long run when the truth comes out early in the process, as opposed to kind of stringing people along.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I like to think about, like, we love you enough to tell you the truth.
Right. Yep. That's a great way to say it. Yeah. After your experience at Waynesburg, you get to Carnegie Mellon. How does that happen?
Yeah. You know, I certainly feel like Coach Christner and, you know, being at Waynesburg for those 2 years really prepared me. You know, I was ready. Obviously I had to move on. My GA job was up. But I was actually coaching an AAU team at the time in Pittsburgh. You know, I was in between jobs coaching AAU. I think I had the 16 and under team. And I was helping out with the 17 under team, and we had a lot of really good players, a lot of scholarship level guys on those two teams. And we always practiced together. And Jeff Van Gorder was the assistant at Carnegie Mellon at the time. And he was recruiting two of the guys on the 17 and under team and came to one of our practices. I had never met Jeff before. He came to practice and I just started talking to him afterward. Ended up asking him, do you know of any jobs? I just finished my GA job looking for that next step. And he said, actually, we have a job that's getting ready to be posted. Are you interested? you bet.
And, right place, right time. Yeah, I like it, Jacob. I
absolutely.
Like it.
Absolutely. So that was kind of the start of it. And then obviously interviewed for it and went through the whole process and ended up at Carnegie Mellon with Jeff and Coach Wingen for one season. And it was really good. I got a lot of perspective in that year, kind of learned about the high academic world. Carnegie Mellon is certainly one of the highest academic schools. And so understanding what it takes to get guys accepted and again, what does it look like to be a good fit at Carnegie Mellon? And it really opened my eyes to the high academic side and to the UAA. I remember being in Coach Christner's office as my time at Waynesburg was wrapping up and, we were trying to figure out what was going to be next. And he asked me, what I want to do. I said, I'd love to be an assistant in the UAA. And now here we are, fast forward 6 years later, I'm on my second stint. It's great. It's a special conference and a lot of really good schools and really good coaches.
Talk a little about the conference. I know we've had a number of different coaches. Obviously, Coach Zimmerman's been on a couple of times with us, but just talk a little bit about what makes the league so special and why, when you were thinking about maybe where you wanted to end up, why the UAA is so special.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, first, I think you just look at the schools. It's made up of a lot of high academic kind of research-based institutions. Some of the best minds and I think being around those type of people and high achievers kind of pushes you, to be better yourself. And certainly, the coaches at those schools and the league does too. But I also think if you look at the track record of Division III and the history, a lot of the top programs in the top 25, there's a lot of UAA schools that kind of fit that mold and have had a ton of success and, just wanted to be among the best that you can be in Division III. Certainly every conference in the country has teams that can compete at a really, really high level. But it was the UAA and certainly the travel, the way we travel is special for Division III. We're flying to a lot of cool cities and getting to have a lot of really, really fun experiences and meaningful experiences for our guys. And I think that's a big part of it as well.
What's the best part? Now you've been at two places that are high academic. What's the best part of coaching players from those types of institutions? What do you like about coaching the guys that can get in and then are thriving in those high academic institutions?
Yeah, I think a lot of the guys at those schools really challenge you to be a better coach. They're guys who always want to know more and want to know why, sometimes to a fault. they want to know too much. And sometimes I don't want to say just because I said so, just do it. But they're insightful guys. They're really good guys. They want to be good and they want to do it at a high level. We talk, you don't have to compromise the academics or the basketball side of things at Emory. That's one of the things we talk about. You can do both at a really high level. And I think those are two things that are really important to me. And so being around, 15, 16 other guys who are all on that same page and working towards a common goal is really special.
From a recruiting standpoint, when you think about the trying to get players at those types of schools, so at Carnegie Mellon, at Emory, I know when we talked to Zimmerman and we talked to David Sloan, who's at Carnegie Mellon, just the fact that you have to first start with the academic side of it. So just talk about what the process looks like there at Emory and how you guys go about first identifying the prospects that you can even put on your radar.
Sure. Yeah, it's a little bit more front end work than some other Division III schools. We rarely when we just go to an AAU tournament or a camp and just try to build a pool of guys. Usually if we're out at those events, we have a group of guys that we know have the grades, they fit what we're looking for in this class. And we want to see them in person to be able to evaluate them. So I think the front end work of doing my research, talking to high school and AAU coaches, you know, certainly we get a lot of emails from a lot of high academic players. So, you know, vetting those out and watching highlights and connecting with those guys and getting their schedules, and then figuring out our schedule based on where those guys are going to be, as opposed to just picking a schedule where we think we'll yield the best and going to those events and sitting down and starting to watch. So it's a little bit different process. The pool size is definitely smaller. You know, the total number of guys we're recruiting is smaller. But it's just different. I don't know that it's better or worse than, you know, Juniata, Carnegie Mellon, Waynesburg. It's just different.
What's interesting is, like, I'm looking at your roster and I see Texas, Ohio, Maryland, Arizona, Tennessee, California, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Florida. You guys are all over the place. So that begs the question of, all right, so you start to identify people, whether that's through recommendations from high school coaches, AAU coaches, people that you've built relationships with. Your budget is obviously not unlimited to be able to fly across the country to be able to see all these guys. So how do you go about narrowing it down? I know that a lot of schools, the high academics in the Northeast, they'll go and maybe go to Yale's camp or they'll go to Cornell's and their elite camp to be able to see players all in one place that have kind of been vetted already academically. Is there anything like that that you guys do to be able to identify players? Or just talk a little bit more about how you go through that entire process. Like, once you're like, okay, this is a kid that we really would like, how do you make sure that you're seeing them enough to make a good judgment on them?
Yeah, we do. We also go to a lot of the Ivy and Patriot League elite camps. You know, that's certainly a place where we're going to probably have the best chance of yielding guys from, just again, because the academics that, you know, most of the guys that are there are, want the high academic profile schools. But we're also fortunate, you know, being in Atlanta, a lot of events in July especially come to Atlanta on one of the two live weekends. So we see a ton of guys during that that July recruiting period as well. But we, you know, as we work through that pool of guys and that list of guys, you know, after we identify the academic fit, you know, it usually comes down to one of the assistants on our staff seeing them, you know, either at one of those camps or we go to an AAU tournament or whatever the case may be. And then we kind of narrow it down even more. You know, Coach Zimmerman gets his list of 5 to 10 guys and he's going to see these guys by the end of summer. You know, whether that's making a trip out west to California for something, you know, for a West Coast Elite event, or, you know, maybe he's going up to the NEPSAC event that's happening at the end of June, you know, whatever the case may be. Once we have those handful of guys that are going to be our priority guys, Coach Zimmerman, we make sure that he's getting a chance to see them in person as much as possible. You know, certainly he can't quite see everybody usually, but we are typically able to get most of those guys in front of him in one way or shape or form. And then, you know, as the fall, as guys get back to campus, we start hosting visits and, kind of, again, we have to, at that point, we have to figure out who are the priority guys. Cause when we get guys to campus, we usually yield pretty well. So we have to make sure that we're getting the right guys at the right time to campus.
How many usually bring on to campus in any given year?
Probably in that 5 to 10 range. It depends on, how big of a class we're recruiting right at the time, but usually it's probably in that 5 to 10 range. And it's a lot different. When I was at Juniata, again, the 3 years before I came down to Emory, we were having 25 to 30 visits and yielding 6, 7, 8. You know, we carried a little bit bigger of a roster there. And we're recruiting a larger number of guys. So again, it kind of goes back to it. I don't think it's better or worse. It's just a different process.
Absolutely.
To go through.
Makes sense. All right. Going from Carnegie Mellon to Juniata. Tell me about that transition and the what, where, why.
Yeah. So Greg Curley, the head coach of Juniata, actually recruited me when I was in high school. So I had known him for a little while. And, you know, Juniata is in central PA, a little over an hour from where I grew up. So I had a lot of familiarity with it. And, you know, I was friends with their assistant coach at the time, who's now the head coach at State College High School, Brian Shawley. And, you know, he as a lot of times what happens in the coaching world, he sends me a text and said, "Hey, I'm probably getting this high school job. You know, would you be interested in coming to Juniata?" And I said, "Yeah, absolutely." You know, at the time at Carnegie Mellon, I was part-time, but I was working it as full-time as possible. I actually was using my teaching degree. I taught three classes in the mornings at a local high school in Pittsburgh, and then was driving over to campus, you know, getting there at lunchtime and spending the rest of the day there, you know, kind of just figuring it out financially until I could get a full-time assistant job. And then
full-time work for part-time pay. I never heard of that before.
Never. It's a novelty in the college basketball world. But yeah, so the opportunity to go to Juniata, you know, be pretty close to home, recruit a lot of the high schools that I grew up playing against and had a ton of, you know, really good relationships with those coaches and some of the kids in the area. And then, like I said, you know, being able to get a full-time assistant job, you know, all those things. It was, I had a really, really good experience at Carnegie Mellon and, loved working for Coach Wingan and with Jeff. But it was kind of one of those things that I just couldn't pass up the opportunity to go, take the job at Juniata whenever I got offered it.
All right. As you're going through these first three experiences, so Waynesburg, Carnegie Mellon, Juniata, what are you developing as, I don't know if I want to say your specialty, but what are you learning on the basketball side of it? What's an area X's and O's wise, or just on the basketball floor, that you felt like you were particularly drawn to, or something that you really enjoyed diving deeper into, offense, defense, something in particular that really you started to feel like, hey, this is kind of where I'm going to butter my bread in my career going forward, if that question makes sense?
Yeah, it does. I, honestly, before I got to Juniata, I don't know that I had that. I think I was still trying to figure that out. You know, as a GA, you're just kind of, I was thrown into it and trying to figure it out. And didn't really know other than the plays that we ran my 4 years at Waynesburg. And then you got to Carnegie Mellon and I really, like I said, that year gave me a ton of perspective, especially on the recruiting side of things. And I was pretty involved in the offense and the dribble drive offense that we installed there. But really, once I got to Juniata, I was drawn to the defensive side of the ball. You know, I mentioned before that's kind of defend and rebound is the name of the game at Juniata. And I fell in love with it. You know, the ability to guard a team for 30 seconds and then not even get a shot off was like, whenever we had those possessions, it was like a thing of beauty. But you know, they have a saying at Juniata, defense is where team basketball begins. Big sign up in the locker room. And that was something that really stuck out to me then, and that I was drawn to. You know, you're going to sacrifice to defend. You're going to sacrifice for your teammates on the defensive end of the floor. You know, it's hard to be a good basketball team if you're going to be selfish defensively. You're just going to watch, you know, your teammate get blown by and be like, "Man, why didn't you guard him?" Like, well, no, you step up and help, and we'll rotate, we'll figure this out together. And so that's something that, you know, I've taken with me. I really, really love the defensive side of the ball, you know, ever since those 3 years.
It's super interesting to hear you say that prior to leaving Waynesburg, it's kind of like you knew Waynesburg, right? And I always say that when I got my first coaching job and I was coaching a JV high school team, my second year out of school. And I remember that basically I ran my practices and I did what my high school coach did and I did what my college coach did. And that was pretty much it. And I always say that one of the things that I regret looking back on it now is I just didn't, now the resources that I would have been had available to me would have been a lot smaller than you have today. Obviously, when I was coaching at that point, that was like 1993, 94. So it wasn't like people weren't looking up stuff on YouTube and be able to get access to film and all the stuff that we have available to us now. But one of the things I regret is I just kind of went with the things that I already knew, and I didn't really get exposed to a whole lot of stuff that was different from just what I experienced as a player. And so for you to be able to go through these different stops and to be able to pick stuff up along the way from the coaches that you were able to pick things up from, and just, as you said, kind of develop and find your voice and find your specialty, your expertise, your thing that was going to be the most important to you as you continued on in your coaching career. I think that that's really, being able to sort of diversify your knowledge is something that as a young coach is super important. It sounds like that's what was able to happen for you at Juniata and just be able to get out on the floor. When you think about roles, how did you define, or how did your head coach there sort of define roles for the staff? Were you just a jack of all trades? Did they have, how did he divide? Obviously the Division III level, you don't have a huge staff. It's just, what were your responsibilities like there?
Yeah. Coach Curley, at the time was also the athletic director there. So I did a lot. Actually, I had a lot on my plate. And then we had a part-time assistant as well, who was an alum. He was a really good player for us. And then, joined the staff after he had graduated. He stayed in the area, and joined the staff. And it was great having him and his ability to relate to the guys. And, they knew where he was coming from because he was in it before they were in their shoes. So that was the makeup of our staff. But I had a lot, going on there with Coach Curley being the AD, and, he promoted me to associate head coach for my third season there whenever I was there, because of that. And, he mentioned in my interview that, this is, you're going to be ready to be a head coach after this job. And I think that's the case. And, I hope someday to be fortunate to have my own team, but that was, I kind of really embraced that and dove into it. Everything from all the scouting reports, recruiting coordinator, setting up camps and running camps, being the camp director in the summer, alumni relations, organizing the alumni game, getting everything set up. And I saw that as an opportunity to just dive in and see every side of it, not just the X's and O's and not just at practice, and, really truly get a full behind the scenes look at everything. I was there during COVID, before COVID and then during COVID, and then right at the end of COVID is when I moved down here to Atlanta. So we actually took that summer whenever everything was shut down, and, we hopped on a Zoom call, the three of us, and we would talk for hours, and we kind of tore the whole program apart and put it back together and figured out what we wanted to keep doing and what we were going to change. And, I think that just gave me a really, really, good look at what it takes to kind of run a program, what it takes to, put everything together, make sure everything works together, and really just break everything down.
Yeah, that wide-ranging view, I think, is something that we've talked to a lot of guys about when you get an opportunity, not just to do things on the floor. It's interesting when you look at the perspective between like Division III versus Division I. Division I, where you have a huge staff and you might have somebody who starts out as an ops, or they're in the video room or whatever it may be, and they're not getting an opportunity to coach on the floor, and they're kind of just in their lane, but they're at the Division I level. And then conversely, you have guys like yourself that start out at the Division III level, you're a GA, then you're a part-time. But in those experiences, you're getting to touch all these different aspects of the program, not just, as you said, the X's and O's, but you're getting a look at like, okay, fundraising and budgeting and travel and scheduling and all these other things that if your goal is to be a head coach, especially at the Division III level, those are things that you're going to have to do that are going to be on your plate eventually as a Division III head coach. And I think that everybody we talk to, and it sounds like you feel the same way, who had that kind of experience, feels like that really did a great job of preparing them for, as you describe, your ultimate eventual opportunity to be a head coach. And I think when you get those experiences, it just really lends itself to you improving and just getting an idea of, hey, this is what it's going to take to eventually become a head coach. Sounds like that's exactly how you feel.
Yeah, it is. And I think those, having those experiences there, but also at Carnegie Mellon and Waynesburg and now at Emory, I think, if I am lucky enough to have my own program someday, I think all four coaches that I've worked for would be able to look at my program and see a little bit of theirs in right. what I do. At least I hope they would be able to see it. Otherwise, I'm not doing a very good job. But I've absolutely taken stuff from each one of those stops and things that I like, things that I don't like, and kind of how you mold it and shape it into what you want it to be. But I've been very fortunate to work for four really, really good bosses.
How are you keeping track of all that stuff that you've learned, both in terms of the things you want to do, the things you don't want to do? You have a notebook, you got a Google Drive. What are you using to kind of sort of put together your coaching portfolio, for lack of a better way of saying it?
Yeah, that's actually kind of a little bit of a summer project for me. Coach Zimmerman is a huge Excel guy. Everything that we do is on Microsoft Excel. But one of the things that I've taken from him is he kind of has this master plan, and it has different tabs at the bottom for, you know, different, without giving away too much of Coach Zimmerman's secrets. it has different tabs, you know, for, you know, a press conference. This is recruiting. This is defense philosophy. This is, baseline out of bounds plays. This is, you know, and it's just this master plan, and he updates it with thoughts, things he likes, goes back and edits and changes. And, so that's something that I'm in the process of trying to, you know, formulate and organize for myself. I have a lot of Word documents right now, just saved in a folder from each of the schools that I've worked at, of things I like, things I want. And I think one thing that's really important too, along with that, is just reading. I have a huge folder that anytime I find an article that I really like, I just print it out. You know, as I read over it, I might highlight something, might underline something, whatever. But I just print it out and put it in that folder. And then from time to time, you know, if I have some time in the office, I'll just pull out the folder and read one of the articles and see what sticks out. It might jog my memory. It might be like, oh man, I actually don't agree with that now. You know, it's a way to kind of challenge yourself to
absolutely
to think about things.
Do you have a go-to source where you go to read?
I really like The Athletic. It's a subscription, but I think it's like $6 or $7 a month or something. I think it's worth it. You know, the ability to kind of customize it and get, you know, your favorite teams, but also they do a lot of like, you know, business, athletic business and athletic culture. And there's a lot of really different, really good different articles on there that you can kind of customize it to what you're looking for.
Yeah, it's great to be able to have resources. And like I said, when you think about what we have today, coaching us as podcast hosts, the things that we can read and see and look at and just be able to pick up knowledge, it's so much easier now than it's ever been. When you just think about the variety of sources, from books to magazines to websites to podcasts, to the ability to just go on and, whether it's Huddle at the high school level or Synergy at the college level or whatever service people are using. I mean, it's just, if you want to get better, there's certainly opportunities to be able to do that. The information is out there. And then I think that the question that we just touched on is, how do you curate all that stuff into something that isn't overwhelming, but that you can actually refer to and reference and sort of build out what you want to be and who you want to be as a coach? Because I've said this a bunch of times in the podcast, there's lots of times where I'll find something like, oh, that's really cool, and I'll write it down or I'll save it. But then you also have to have a system, not just for writing it down and saving it, but also going back and reviewing it and deciding, like you said, is this something that I still believe could work? Is this something that's relevant to my team or my situation right now? Or is it something that you get rid of? It's one thing to grab something and put it in a Word document or grab something and make a copy of it, but then it's another thing altogether to be able to implement it. And I think the combination of being organized, but then also actually figuring out what you can implement and what you can't, I think to me, that's a real key to being able to learn and grow as a coach is those two things.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think also along with that, surrounding yourself with, you know, a circle of other coaches, whether it could be any level of college coaches, some high school coaches, prep school coaches, you know, whatever the case would be, surrounding yourself with guys who are in that same mind as you and working on towards similar goals that you can bounce ideas off of. You know, Dave Sloan, for example, at Carnegie Mellon, he had on a little bit ago, is one of my best friends in coaching, and we talk pretty much daily. And we're, you know, he's a big Princeton offense fan, and I'm not so much, and I give him a hard time about that, but it's something that I want to learn more about the Princeton offense, so I'm going to talk to Coach Sloan about it. So I think surrounding yourself with a lot of really high level basketball coaches as well, and just picking their brain and having conversations is super important.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your coaching portfolio guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
What I found, and this has been something that now, after having been doing the podcast for 5 years, we've come to the realization quite a while ago that just how willing everybody is to share. And, you know, obviously you're not giving away all your trade secrets, but just the number of coaches that care about the game of basketball. I mean, obviously they care about their team, they care about their one loss record, they care about their players, but ultimately people just love the game. And as a result of that, they want to share and they want to make things better for the game of basketball and for everybody who's involved in it. I think that's one of the things that has been really refreshing about the podcast. And it wasn't something that necessarily we thought of when we first started, but it's been something that we've really enjoyed, is just the fact that you can have people on and they're willing to talk about their journey and talk about what they do and talk about how they've had success. And hopefully in the course of that, they're sharing things that makes the game better for everybody. And ultimately, I think that's when we all win, because we all love the game of basketball. And it's been obviously very good to you. And Jason and I feel the same way about what basketball has done for us. And so that's what makes it really special. Let's talk a little bit about the opportunity at Emory and how you get connected with Coach Zimmerman, how that opening comes to your attention, and talk about the decision to leave Juniata and leave the state of Pennsylvania and leave home and head down to Atlanta.
Yeah, for sure. I first met Coach Zimmerman whenever I was at Carnegie Mellon, you know, obviously being in the same conference. We're playing him twice a year and seeing him out on the road and everything. So I had known him and, you know, we were acquaintances and some of that, but we really reconnected, you know, part of that, like I said, part of that COVID times while I was at Juniata was we tore everything apart and built it back together. And one of the things we were considering was playing a little more up tempo, or being a little more opportunistic in transition is probably the best way to put it, than we were. And so I decided to pick up the phone and call the team that I know plays the fastest. So I called Coach Zimmerman and, picked his brain a little bit about, their transition and the tempo and, decision-making and shot selection. And I had all these questions for him, and, it was really good. It was really insightful, obviously. And then afterwards we were just kind of catching up and connecting a little bit. And I was, without going too far into it, we were dating at the time. She was down here in Atlanta and I was in Pennsylvania. And, it kind of all worked out that there was an opportunity for me to join the staff here, cause I had been planning on proposing and we got engaged, and then it was time to decide, was she moving to Pennsylvania or was I moving to Atlanta? Coach Zimmerman, really helped me out by offering me a job here on staff and bringing me down here. And that was, ultimately what was a big part. It was a personal move, but also a professional move as well. But it was one that it's been great. I've had a phenomenal experience, and, working for Coach Zimmerman is awesome. It was a little bit of an eye opener coming down here. Like I said, Juniata, we were, defend, rebound, run motion, make you guard. And at Emory, we do not do that. it's the other end of the spectrum here. We play fast. We shoot a lot.
Getting up and down the floor.
Press and switch everything. And so it was like two totally different styles. And I think that polarization was so good for me. It was like hard. It was like culture shock for me at first. But it's been so good for me. It's really challenged me to do I actually believe, especially on the defensive side of the ball, do I actually believe what I think I believe? Because we're doing it literally the opposite of what I just did for 3 years and everything that I built the foundation on what I wanted to do. now we're doing the opposite of it. And so it was really, really good for me professionally. And I think probably more so than anything else down here, I've tried to be intentional, and I really feel like I've made progress in having more of a feel for when to make what decisions, as opposed to this is what we do, how we do it, figure it out how to do it this way. Having a little bit more of a feel for the game and when to make decisions, and when should we go zone for two possessions to throw a curveball out there, as opposed to my personal preference is 40 minutes of man and we're going to wear you down. And so just being challenged in that way a lot was really good, and it's really helped kind of shape the way I view the game now.
Being more flexible and also, right, just again, being exposed to a whole new style of play and a different way of attacking the game. I think it's interesting when you look, again, you as somebody that studies the game at various levels and talking about earlier watching NBA games when you started coaching, but there's just so many different ways to play the game. And you can watch one program and one team and be like, okay, they're really successful with that. But then to your point, you can be somewhere else and see another program that is equally as successful doing it almost in the complete polar opposite way. And that gets to figuring out what you are and who you are and what you really believe as a coach. And sometimes you just need to get enough exposure to different systems and different coaching styles to be able to figure out kind of where you fit on the spectrum. So eventually when you do get your own program, as you said, you're going to take bits and pieces of each one of the programs and each one of the coaches that you work for, and then ultimately mold them into who you're going to be as a head coach. And I think that when you have a multitude of experiences like you've had under different people with different playing styles, that's ultimately, as you said, going to make you a better coach, because you're going to be more flexible and open-minded as to, okay, how do we want to play? Maybe you dictate it more based off your personnel in a given year, and you just have more knowledge of these different systems or bits and pieces of these systems that can work for you, and you eventually become a head coach. What do you think about when you consider what you learned thus far from Coach Zimmerman? And let's not break it down to necessarily the X's and O's, but just when you think about what it takes to run a successful basketball program, which obviously he's been there for more than a decade and he's done nothing but win since he's been there. So when you think about what he's done in order to do that and what you've learned, what are some of the things that stick out for you?
Yeah. One of the things we've talked a lot lately about, and I've been thinking a lot lately about, is the idea that rarely is it are things super complicated, but a lot of times they're hard to do. Things are pretty simple, but they're hard to do. Like, I think there's a Nick Saban quote that if you want to be great, you really don't have a lot of choices.
Right.
there's really a standard. There's really a standard of what you have to do to be great. And that's probably oversimplifying it, but the point remains, you know, what we do, X's and O's, we get taught a lot. Like, we're very easy to scout, but we're really hard to play against. And so that idea of, you know, what we do, we're going to run in transition, and, you know, you're going to have to do it with us for 40 minutes. And a lot of times we'll see teams can hang and hang and hang, but then down the stretch, you know, we're still going, we're still conditioned to do it and disciplined to do it. And, you know, guys will ask, like, oh, when you recruit, do you have to, you know, are you looking for the fastest players out there? And we tell guys all the time, we don't really necessarily care how fast you are. Do you have the discipline to run every time? And so I think that's one of the biggest things I've taken away from him, is that, you know, it can be simple, but it's really hard to do. And sometimes that's some of the best things are that way. And if you're able to have the discipline to do it and the, you know, the fortitude to stick with it and do it consistently. And we talk about staying power a lot, and the ability to just be there every time, to do it consistently every time, to show up every time. If you're able to do that, you know, you're going to have a chance to have success.
To be a pain in the butt to play against, right? I mean,
absolutely.
That's ultimately what it comes down to. When you're talking about that, and look, I'm 53 years old. I haven't played college basketball for 30 some odd years. But when I think about myself as a player, or what I've tried to teach my kids when they play, it's like, I might not be the fastest guy in the first 4 minutes of the game. Like, there's guys that when I played, if you're going to set me up and you're going to have me run one sprint from one end of the floor to the other, there's lots of guys that I played against that probably were going to beat me. But with 2 minutes left in the game, when we've been running all game and I'm still running at close to full capacity and they're not, now suddenly I look a lot faster. And I think that's kind of what you're getting at, is you got to have the mental toughness and discipline to be able to do what you do in the first minute of the game. You got to still be able to do that in the last minute of the game. And that's something that conditioning is obviously a part of that, but part of that is just the mental toughness. So let me ask you this. When you start trying to develop that skill in players, obviously part of that is watching them while you're recruiting them and trying to figure out if they have that in them already. I don't want to say naturally, but if they have that in them. But obviously that's something that you can continue to improve and develop and emphasize. So what do you guys do as part of the program there to make sure that your guys understand how important that piece of it is? What are you talking about? What are you doing in practice day in and day out to emphasize that particular, I guess I'll call it a skill?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. It definitely does start in the recruiting process. Like I said, we don't necessarily have to have the fastest guys, but I think the laying it out, you know, especially when we bring them to campus and, you know, we do a little bit of film work during our visits, but so guys understand what they're getting into. I don't think they ever fully get it until they're thrown into it and they're gassed after the first week of conditioning.
Absolutely. Yeah. You're not figuring that out on a high school team. Let's put it that way. You can be told how much that's going to happen, but until it happens, yeah, you're not getting it.
Exactly. I think a big part of the culture of our program, you know, we have kind of the senior leadership that keeps getting passed down, and it's such a big part of Division III in general. In my opinion, some of the most, probably the most successful Division III programs, a huge part of it is just the leadership and the way that guys approach the offseason, both preseason and postseason. It's such a big part of Division III basketball. But our guys set that tone with, you know, the way we play open gym in the fall, and, you know, they understand the standard and what it takes to be successful at Emory. And then also our strength and conditioning staff, they do a really good job with our guys in the preseason. You know, whenever we're not allowed to be in there working with the guys, you know, they know exactly what we as coaches need come October 15th when we're going. And they do a great job of preparing our guys.
What's your role in the off season right now? Because we've talked to a lot of Division III head coaches and kind of asked them, well, hey, what are you doing during this time when you can't be with your guys? It's not like the Division I level where you can be having workouts every day and all the things that they do at that level. So when you think about what you're doing right now in the off season, it's June 8th. What are your day-to-day tasks? What are you doing throughout the months when you can't have that contact directly with your players?
Yeah, right now, June is pretty crazy with our camps. Actually, our day camps, we have 3 out of 4 weeks. We have youth day camp. We just finished one up today, actually. So that's
nice.
That's on the forefront of everything we're doing right now. But, you know, recruiting never really stops. You know, we're constantly trying to evaluate guys, and even the guys we know now, we're getting full game film and watching that. We're getting updated transcripts. We're calling guys, texting guys. We always try to have a little bit of a summer project every summer that we work on, usually involving some film work. You know, last summer, my big project was taking the top, I think I did the top 5 defenses in Division 1, 2, and 3, and just watching a bunch of each of their games and trying to figure out, are there common threads? Is there something that we can take from these teams that are really good defensively to implement into what we do to make us better defensively? And a lot of that, it boiled down to a lot of the pace of games and possession, which obviously we play high possession games. So that was a little bit challenging to keep things in context there. But I always have a little bit of a summer project like that I'm working on and working through and that we're talking about as a staff.
What's the project for this summer?
Right now, currently we're going back and watching our conference games. You know, we use SportsCode to cut some different clips out of them. And so we have a big code window, and we're looking for watching specific actions and kind of what happens the most and how can we teach those areas better, you know, next season, and obviously, and preparing film work for the fall when guys get back. And this year, Division III has a little bit of a change. You know, we're allowed 8 days outside of the October 15th through the end of your season window this year for the first time. So we're really trying to figure out how to best use those 8 days to prepare our guys for the team, or prepare the team for the season. You know, so that October 15th, we're in the best position we can to really be going daily.
What's the plan so far? What do you got? What are you thinking?
We're the big the big topic is how many, if any, do we save for the spring? You know, like I said, the leadership of your seniors and that off season work is so, so important with Division III because our guys aren't on campus all summer. And so, you know, how to manage the spring so that guys fully understand what, you know, what they need to be doing over the summer to come back, you know, in the best position possible. So, it's looking like we're leaning towards saving some days for the spring, a day or two in the spring to do that summer work. But then, you know, also using, I guess that leaves us, you know, either six or seven in the fall and, a combination of teaching and installing some stuff, but really letting guys play and us having a chance to evaluate our freshmen and seeing, you know, who's ready to take a different role and what their growth is going to look like.
Yeah, I would think that obviously there's a ton of value in it in a lot of different ways, but I would think that just being able to have that contact on the floor with your freshmen who are not only coming in fresh as basketball players, but also just coming in as students, to be able to get them out on the basketball court, which is obviously a huge part of the reason why they choose Emory. So to be able to be connected to those guys on the basketball floor, I would think would have to be huge, A, for you going into the season, but also just for those guys transitioning from being high school student athletes to being college student athletes. I got to believe that that's going to be something that is really going to help, again, not just every program, but it's going to help those kids to make that transition.
Yeah, absolutely. And that opportunity to play more in an organized setting with our teammates, to get to know us as coaches better and our style, right, and how we function on the floor too. Again, really helps set expectations.
When you think about how Coach Zimmerman develops leaders in the program, and you mentioned how important leadership is at the Division III level, especially when it comes to making sure that guys are doing what they need to do in the off season. When you look at it from an assistant coaching perspective, how do you try to give kids an opportunity to develop that leadership? What do you guys do as a staff to make sure that there's room for players to grow as leaders and that all the leadership isn't coming through you as the coaching staff?
Yeah, I think it goes back to, you know, loving guys enough to tell them the truth and establishing a role for a guy. You know, I think some of our best leaders that we've had at Emory, and I certainly wasn't here for all of them, but you know, as we talk and as I meet them now as alumni, some of the best leaders and ambassadors of the program and what it means to live out the code at Emory, they weren't necessarily the guys that played the most or had the most points or the best stats or any of that, but it was guys who really trusted the coaching staff, obviously, but their teammates. And they could be trusted. That's a huge part of it. The ability to have guys trust you and understand that your intentions are for the team and to leave the jersey in a better place than where you found it. And obviously guys that are committed to the team and to making themselves and the team better. And guys that care about, care about their teammates, care about the program, care about their coaches. Guys who embody those characteristics. I think that's usually the most telling signs of who has the leadership potential and who are going to be your leaders ultimately. And that's a process for sure. It's not something that they just walk in the office and you see it. And some guys have it inherently more than others.
Right.
But there's certainly a process of kind of going through it and having experiences and coming out the other side of it, and understanding, what it looks like. And like I said, we've had, a big part of our ability to sustain our success has been because guys really buy into what we're trying to do, and they they carry that responsibility of it matters, where we leave the jersey in 4 years.
All right, let me ask you this, because I think this is something that is sometimes difficult for both players and coaches to navigate. It's obviously easy to develop a leader if that leader who kind of develops naturally is your best player. And if your best player is your leader, then people can follow them both on and off the floor. And that player kind of has a natural authority because they're your best player. And that happens sometimes, but obviously you know well that it doesn't always happen that your best player on the floor isn't necessarily always your best leader. So how do you get your players to, I don't know if the right word is respect, but how do you get your players to buy into somebody as a leader who maybe doesn't have a huge role on the floor? So like maybe you have a guy who doesn't play a whole lot, but he's the guy in the weight room who kind of leads and shows the way and is super intense. Or maybe you have a guy who doesn't play a lot and he's on the bench and he's always cheering and just is a great teammate. I think it's important for coaching staffs to be able to empower those guys. So how do you approach that when maybe your best player isn't your best leader, but you have other leaders, but maybe they just don't have as big a role on the floor? How do you make sure that all your team are buying into those kinds of leaders?
Sure. Yeah. I think the actions speak louder than words sometimes. And I think, you know, the way that guys go about their daily business, you know, whether that's in the weight room, as you mentioned, or on the floor before practice in our pre-practice sessions, or, you know, even in practice, how they handle adversity in games, you know, are they a fountain or a drain, as Coach Copper, one of our other assistants, talks about a lot. You know, are you draining the energy from the team? Are you taking the team's and the coaching staff's energy, or are you giving it? Are you providing it for the team? Are you building guys up? Are you bringing guys along? Are you there to kick them in the butt when they need it? And then love them in the locker room after practice. You know, that's a huge part of it, that, you know, the actions speak louder than words. And I think when guys see, you know, somebody who really cares and really goes about it the right way and is committed to doing it, that's where that leadership grows, regardless of their production on the floor, or their role on the floor, you know, how many minutes they're playing, just the way that they handle their business and go about their business and interact with teammates. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I want to know that I can trust the guy sitting next to me on the bench, you know, regardless of what their role is. And so I think their ability to connect with guys and be connectors is important.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think when you give players that opportunity and you as a coaching staff recognize the contributions of everybody, regardless of their role on the floor, but you make everybody's role equally important, that I think that's really where you get those types of leaders that we just talked about showing up. We've had an opportunity to talk to you about all your different stops. And obviously throughout the course of the conversation, we talked about your eventual goal to be a Division III head coach. So when you look at the things that you've learned and you were trying to sell yourself to a program as a head coach, what do you think are one or two qualities about yourself that, if you were to get an opportunity, you feel like would be drivers of your success?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think the way that I approach the game, and you know, it's not necessarily the X's and O's side of things, but, and maybe the game isn't the right way to put it, the way that I would approach a program in terms of, you know, my care for the guys that I bring in and recruit and are my end up being my players. You know, the way that I interact in an athletic department, and the ability to build relationships and, you know, to understand the department as a whole is a team as well, you know, that we're on. But really, really building that team, like I mentioned, the quote of Juniata on the wall, like, defense is where team basketball begins. Understanding how to build a team and bring guys together and how it all fits together. You know, a lot of times it's not the best players, just put your five best players out there and let them go. It's how do all the pieces connect and fit together. And so having relationships with your guys, understanding your guys and what makes them tick and how they need to be coached, and just that ability to connect is so important. And I think that's one of the biggest things that I've learned over my 8 years. You know, it's a collective. It's not just, let's just recruit the best players and get them here, and that's going to solve all our problems. Because honestly, that might create more problems than it's actually solved. So I think understanding the bigger picture of things is probably the simplest way to put it.
Yeah, there's more than putting together a team than just throwing a collection of talent out on the floor. You certainly have to have guys that fit in and buy in and work well together and fit the culture of what you're trying to build. Makes complete sense. All right, one final two-part question here, Jacob.
Sure.
Part one, when you look ahead over the next year or two, what do you see as being your biggest challenge? And then the second part of the question, when you think about what you get to do every day, what's your biggest joy? So your biggest challenge and then your biggest joy.
Yeah. And that's just to clarify, that's my biggest challenge personally.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
That's a good question. I think my biggest challenge personally coming up, will be to continue, you know, we feel like we have a string of a couple really good recruiting classes. And I think the more that you do that, sometimes the harder it can be because guys don't necessarily see opportunity, because there's a lot of really good young guys playing a lot of minutes. And so I think that's a big challenge moving forward, will be the recruiting. And I think this class that we're working on, the class of 24, is really important. And that's one of my concerns for this class, is that guys don't necessarily see that, because we only, we only graduate two guys in, this coming year, maybe a third. There's one of our players has an opportunity for a fifth year if he wants it, and we're still working through that decision with him, and that's fine. But trying to figure out how to fill in the cracks that we still do have in our roster, but being very specific and very intentional about how we're doing that. I think it's going to be a challenge. I think it's going to be really beneficial for me to go through that process. Once we do get to the other side of it. But that's one of my biggest, challenges that I think I'm facing. And I think one of the biggest joys for me, is now, going into year three, having played a role in recruiting the majority of the team now, as opposed to, your first year. So whenever you get there, it's, the guys are there, they're in place, and you're coming in and joining them, and how do you fit in and, add value to what's going on. But now, those relationships just continue to get deeper, continue to get better. You're in it a lot more. You're not trying to just figure it all out. I think that's something that I'm really excited about, is seeing these guys that, I quote unquote came in with, all the freshmen that first year that I got here. And now they're in their third year, they're juniors, and kind of going through that whole process with them, as well as adding guys that can help us, ultimately, go as far as we can in the NCAA tournament. That's our goal, obviously, to play as many games as possible in March. So that's what I'm really excited about, that whole process.
That's a double-edged sword, right? You have tons of talent that you've recruited, but now you got to find a way to maximize those guys and keep everybody bought in when there may not be as many minutes as maybe people had hoped, right? So let's put it this way. It's a good problem to have. It's better to be on that side of the equation than searching for talent. Let's put it that way.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. It is. It's a double-edged sword for sure.
All right. Before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share how people can connect with you, social media, email, program, website, whatever you want to share. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Sure. Yeah. On most social media platforms, my handle is @coach_fleegs, FLEEGZ. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram primarily are my two. I don't post a lot of content. I'm more of just a scroller and looker and reader.
There you go.
Find articles on there, find different things that, that can be beneficial. And then, my email address is on our website, jflegl@emory.edu. Feel free to shoot an email. I'd love to connect.
Awesome. Jacob, cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule tonight to join us. Really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.